The Meaning of Marxism by Paul D'Amato. Section. You can't skin a tiger paw by paw. There have been moderates in the socialist movement that have made the case for peaceful reform rather than revolution as the most, quote, realistic way to achieve socialism. The German social democratic revisionists in the early 20th century, social democracy was the name given to socialist parties at the time, are the best known. Their leading spokesperson, Eduard Bernstein, argued that capitalism, no longer crisis-prone, was softening class antagonisms by slowly improving workers' living standards. The growth of trade unions and cooperatives, and above all, winning a socialist majority in parliament, were all that was needed. And if they didn't frighten away businesses by moving in too radical a direction, German social democrats could slowly but surely bring about socialism. Socialism was no longer an economic, but rather a moral imperative, and as such could also be appealing to the well-to-do. Bernstein's famous dictum was that the ultimate aim of socialism is nothing, but the movement is everything. But revisionism, named for its revising of Marx's revolutionary doctrine, also had a peculiar conception of just what the movement was. It denigrated the importance of struggle, such as strikes and street protests. These were seen as too disruptive, too threatening to the bourgeoisie, whom the reformists hoped to placate by only demanding incremental change. For the record, Bernstein also supported colonialism, defending the right of, quote, civilized peoples to act as guardians of the uncivilized. There are two problems with this view of socialism. The first is that in this scenario, workers do not liberate themselves. They depend on others to make changes on their behalf. Class struggle plays no role except as a means to exert pressure on the top. Workers do not learn through their own action how to construct a new world. They are at best a mere stage army, or worse, a passive voting bloc. But the second and most important problem with reformism is that it doesn't work, for the simple reason that those who hold power won't give it up voluntarily or peacefully. No privileged class, wrote Albert Rice Williams, a witness to the 1917 revolution in Russia, voluntarily resigns any of its privileges. No class steeped in tradition discards the old and gladly embraces the new. End quote. If socialism is really to be the expropriation of wealth and the socialization of production, that means depriving the bosses of their power and taking away their wealth and their ability to extort any more wealth. Whether you propose to do this in small installments or all at once, the ruling class will resist with all their might. Or, as the British historian R.H. Tawney put it, onions can be eaten leaf by leaf, but you cannot skin a live tiger paw by paw. When Southern U.S. slaveholders found their monopoly of political power undermined in Washington as a result of the creation of non-slave states in the 1850s, they resorted to secession and war to protect their economic and political power. Even assuming socialists could gain a majority of elected positions in government, they would still face a pro-slavery rebellion, an all-out effort by the capitalist class to ensure that such a government either acquiesced to their interests or was swept aside. That is why they have police, armies, and prisons. The purpose of armed force is to act as the last line of defense against any attempt to challenge capitalism. There are times when even formal democracy becomes too threatening to the powers that be, as the many military coups around the world show. Rosa Luxemburg pointed this out at the turn of the 20th century. Quote, "In this society, the representative institutions, democratic in form, are in content the instruments of the interests of the ruling class. This manifests itself in a tangible fashion in the fact that as soon as democracy shows the tendency to negate its class character and becomes transformed into an instrument of the real interests of the population, the democratic forms are sacrificed by the bourgeoisie and its state representatives." End quote. This is certainly what happened in Chile in 1973. The electoral victory of the Popular Unity Socialist Government gave encouragement to a series of mass strikes, along with factory and land takeovers. President Salvador Allende preached a peaceful, constitutional, Chilean road to socialism, attempting at every turn to restrain the mass movement in order to prove his commitment to constitutionalism. He brought military generals into his cabinet, including Pinochet, the man who would soon lead the coup against him, assuring the populace that the officers respected the Constitution. He signed a Statute of Guarantees not to touch the armed forces or the legal and educational systems, and authorized the army to conduct searches of factories to confiscate arms workers were stockpiling to defend themselves against fascist gangs. Unfortunately, Chile's wealthy were committed to the Constitution only insofar as it guaranteed their rule. Fearing the growing working class movement, they threw their support behind a brutal military coup. Under the command of General Augusto Pinochet, the army murdered Allende in the presidential palace and crushed the workers' movement in blood. Allende's constitutionalism merely disoriented the mass movement, allowing General Pinochet the breathing room he needed to destroy it. Communist parties, CPs, throughout the world at that time, who long before had abandoned revolutionary Marxism under the tutelage of Stalinist Russia in the 1930s and 40s, drew deeply conservative conclusions from Allende's defeat. The problem was not that Allende disarmed the workers' movement and opened the door to defeat, but that the class struggle had gone too far and had thereby provoked the reaction. The tragic Chilean experience has demonstrated, fretted Italian CP leader Enrico Berlinguer, how the anti-democratic reaction tends to become more violent and ferocious when popular forces begin to conquer the fundamental levers of power in society and state. Berlinguer's conclusion was that the working class should compromise with capitalism rather than try to conquer fundamental power. "Liberalism has always said to the workers that by their class struggle they provoke the reaction," wrote Trotsky. Quote, "The reformists repeated this accusation against the Marxists. These accusations reduce themselves, in the final analysis, to the profound thought that if the oppressed balk, the oppressors will not be obliged to beat them." End quote. Marx and Engels were sharply critical of what they called parliamentary cretinism, the tendency to place all hopes for social change on parliamentary institutions. They ridiculed social democrats who, while putting off socialism as an heirloom for their children, focus attention on all sorts of trifles, tinkering away at the capitalist social order, so that at least something should appear to be done without at the same time alarming the bourgeoisie. Marx and Engels were not opposed to electoral campaigns. But for them, elections were good opportunities for revolutionaries to bring before the public their revolutionary attitude. They heaped scorn on socialists who saw their task as getting educated men elected in order to represent workers' interests from above. "We cannot cooperate," they snapped in an angry circular to German socialist leaders, "with men who say openly that the workers are too uneducated to emancipate themselves and must first be emancipated from above by philanthropic members of the upper and lower middle classes." The whole process of seeking electoral victory at all costs created a trend among the reformists to broaden their mass appeal by toning down their politics. Instead of politics being guided by principles, reformism fell into opportunism, what Rosa Luxemburg described as sacrificing the basic principles of class struggle for momentary advantage. This has certainly been the experience of socialist parties that have been elected to office throughout history. Instead of challenging capitalism, they have ended up as its apologists, adapting to it rather than transforming it. During the First World War, the leaders of the German Social Democratic Party, along with the leaders of the other main socialist parties in Europe, cast their support for their own government's war effort, completely abandoning the principle of working class internationalism laid down in the Communist Manifesto. For this system, "not one man, not one penny," had once been the party's slogan. Reformists had degraded Marxism from a movement of revolutionary internationalism into one of national reformism. The German socialist Karl Kautsky offered as an excuse for European socialism's collapse into opportunism that the Socialist International, quote, "is essentially an instrument of peace, and therefore ineffective in wartime." Quote, "The global historical appeal of the Communist Manifesto undergoes a fundamental revision," wrote Luxemburg in 1915, "and, as amended, now reads, proletarians of all countries, unite in peacetime and cut each other's throats in war." End quote. There are more reasons. French socialist François Mitterrand in the 1980s and Lionel Jospin in the 1990s implemented policies that helped to gut France's social safety net and enabled the French bosses to stay profitable. Mitterrand's election to the presidency in 1981 initially struck fear into French capitalists. He quickly allayed them by embarking on a series of austerity measures that included a wage freeze and a plan for restructuring French industry designed to weaken the unions and, in the words of Daniel Singer, sacrifice many of their conquests on the altar of flexibility. Mitterrand, like Bill Clinton in the 1990s, was able to push through a series of conservative measures without provoking the same level of working class resistance that would have resulted had a right-wing government attempted to impose them. Along with this went a new ultra-moderate image. "To say that French socialism had mellowed is an understatement," wrote Singer. "The concepts of class and capitalism, even the very word socialism, had disappeared from their vocabulary." For this, capital was eternally grateful. The French Stock Exchange, the Bourse, rose at twice the rate of the New York Stock Exchange during Mitterrand's presidency. When Mitterrand was elected, according to Singer, he was viewed with suspicion. 5 years later, when the defeated socialists were leaving the government, the only president was being hailed unanimously by The Economist, the Financial Times, and the Wall Street Journal as a wise statesman, having done yeoman service for the left, for France, and for the Western world. If the old social democrats shared with Stalinism an identification of socialism with the state, modern socialist parties in Europe have even dropped the pretense of being for any kind of socialism. After the Second World War, European social democratic parties were advocates of a, quote, mixed economy, somewhere between the market and state ownership of the means of production. In the era of neoliberalism, they abandoned a commitment even to state socialism. Instead, they now argue for a third way, and have become open supporters of neoliberal austerity policies aimed at cutting the social wage and eroding labor rights. In this way, they have cut themselves off more and more from their former working-class supporters. Reformism would only work if the state were a neutral body, an empty vessel to be filled up by whichever party gets into office. Luxemburg, in her epitaph on the failure of reformism, noted that those who favor legislative reform over social revolution, quote, do not really choose a more tranquil, calmer, and slower road to the same goal, but a different goal. Instead of a stand for the establishment of a new society, they take a stand for the surface modifications of the old society. End quote. It is important to remember, however, that rejecting reformism is not the same as rejecting reforms, and in particular, the fight for reforms. It is precisely through struggles for immediate demands, over wages, working conditions, and for political and social improvements, that workers are able to develop a consciousness of their own power, as well as the confidence born of collective action to move towards revolutionary action. Struggle changes consciousness. That is why the fight for reforms has the potential to go further, because once in the struggle, the horizons of work expand beyond their immediate conditions. The possibility of another world looms more closely on the horizon. But the struggle for reforms cannot be equated with revolution. In a revolution, that is, in a period of mass upheaval and social convulsion, consciousness is transformed on a mass scale. This transformation is both a condition and a result of revolution. As Marx and Engels wrote, quote, both for the production on a mass scale of this communist consciousness, and for the success of the cause itself, the alteration of men on a mass scale is necessary, an alteration which can only take place in a practical movement, a revolution. This revolution is necessary, therefore, not only because the ruling class cannot be overthrown in any other way, but also because the class overthrowing it can only in a revolution succeed in ridding itself of all the muck of ages and become fitted to found society anew. End of quote and end of section.